I'm sorry. Anger became a razor.
I see, she said flatly, and glided out of the room.
So, both feet put wrong, straight into his mouth, it seemed, though he could not understand how. He had apologized, and he had not even done anything to apologize for. That afternoon, he overheard Bane and Chia discussing whether they should help Fail beat him, of all things. No telling whether Fail had suggested it. She was fierce, but was she that fierce? Yet he suspected the pair meant him to hear, which made him angry. Plainly his wife was discussing affairs between him and her with them, matters which should have remained between husband and wife, which made him angrier. What other parts of their life did she chat about over tea? That night, as he watched in amazement, Fail put on a thick wool nightgown, despite the heat. When he tried to kiss her cheek, almost timidly, she muttered that she had had a tiring day and rolled over with her back to him. She smelled furious, sharp enough to split a razor edgewise. He could not sleep with that smell, and the longer he lay there beside her, studying the ceiling in the darkness, the angrier he became. Why was she doing this? Could she not see he loved her and only her? Had he not shown her time and again that what he wanted more than anything in life was to hold her forever? Was he to blame because some fool woman got a bee up her nose and wanted to flirt? What he ought to do was turn her upside down and smack her bottom till she saw sense. Only he had done that once before, when she thought she could hit him with her fist whenever she wanted to make a point. In the long run, it had hurt him a lot more than it had her. He did not like even the thought of Fail being hurt. He wanted peace with her. With her and only her. Which was why he made the decision he made lying there, with gray first light of their sixth day in Carrion showing in the windows. In the stone, Berylaine had flirted with a dozen men that he knew of. Whatever had made her choose him as her quarry, she would settle on another if he was out of sight for very long. And once Berylaine chose another victim, Fail would come to her senses. It seemed simple. So, as soon as he could throw on some clothes, he went off to find Loyal and breakfast with him, then accompanied him to the Royal Library. Once he saw that slender Aes Sedai, and Loyal told him she was there every day. Loyal was diffident around Aes Sedai, but he did not mind 50 of them around him. Perrin sniffed out Gaul and asked whether he would like to go hunting. There were not many deer or rabbits in the hills close to the city, of course, and those few suffering as much from the drought as the people, yet Perrin's nose could have led them to any number they needed if meat had really been what he was after. He never even knocked an arrow, but he insisted on remaining out until Gaul asked whether he intended hunting bats by the light of the half-moon. Sometimes Perrin forgot that other people could not see as well as he in the night. The next day he hunted into the darkness as well, and every day thereafter. The problem of it was, his simple plan seemed to be falling on its nose. The first night when he returned to the Sun Palace, with his unstrung bow on his shoulder, pleasantly tired from all that walking, only a chance stir in the air brought Berylaine's scent in time to stop him from walking into the main entry hall of the palace. Motioning the Aiel guards to silence, Perrin sneaked all the way around to a servant's door, where he had to pound to make a bleary-eyed fellow let him in. The next night, Berylaine was waiting in the hallway outside his rooms. He had to hide around a corner half the night before she gave up. Every night she was waiting somewhere, as if she could pretend a chance encounter, when no one else was awake but a few servants. It was utter madness. Why had she not gone on to someone else? And every night, when he at last crept into his bedchamber with his boots in his hands, Fail was asleep in that bloody thick nightgown. Long before his sixth sleepless night in a row, he was ready to admit he had blundered, though he still could not see how. It had seemed so bloody simple. All he wanted was one word from Fail, one hint of what he should say or do. All he got was the sound of his own teeth grinding in the darkness. On the tenth day, Rand received another request from Coiran for an audience, just as politely worded as the first three. For a time he sat rubbing the thick, creamy parchment between thumb and forefinger, thinking. There was really no way to tell how far Alana was yet from his sense of her, but comparing how strong it had been the first day with how strong it was now, he thought she might be halfway to Kyrian. If that was so, Mirana was not dawdling. That was good. He wanted her eager. Penitent, at least a little, would help too, but as well wish for the moon. She was Aes Sedai. 10 more days until they reached Kyrian, if they kept that pace, and they should be able to. Time enough to meet twice more with Coiran, so he would have given each group 3 audiences. Let Mirana consider that when she arrived. No advantage to her at all. The White Tower on the other side, and no need for her to know he would as soon stick his hand into a viper pit as go anywhere near the tower, especially with Elida as Amelin. 10 more days, and he would eat his boots if 10 more passed beyond that before Mirana agreed to throw Saladar's support to him, with no nonsense about guiding or showing the way. Then at last he could turn his full attention on Samael. As Rand sat to write Corin that she could bring 2 of her sisters to the Sun Palace tomorrow afternoon, Luz Theron began muttering audibly,
"Yes, Samael. Kill him this time. Dimandred and Samael and all of them this time. Yes, I will."
Rand hardly noticed. Chapter 51. The Taking. Rand let Sulin hold his coat for him to put on, for the simple reason that he would have had to rip it out of her hands physically to do otherwise. As usual, she tried to shove the garment onto him with no regard to details, such as where his arms happened to be. The result was a small dance in the middle of his bedchamber. Luz Theron cackled with a sort of mad delight, just loud enough to be heard.
"Samael, oh yes, but Dimandred first. First of all, I rid myself of him. Then Samael, oh yes!"
If the man had had hands, he would have been rubbing them in glee. Rand ignored him.
"Be respectful," Sulin muttered under her breath. "You did not show respect to those Aes Sedai in Camelon, and you saw what came of it. The wise ones... I have heard the wise ones say things. You must be respectful, my lord dragon," she added as an afterthought.
At last he managed to wrench the coat on the rest of the way. "Has Min come yet?"
"Do you see her, my lord dragon?"
Picking imaginary lint from the red silk, Sulin began doing up his buttons. It was faster to put his hands down and let her.
"Min will come when she comes, if she comes. Soralia will be done with her in the tents when she is done."
Suddenly she peered up at him sharply.
"What do you want with her? You hardly want your bottom pinched while the Aes Sedai are here."
There was no hidden smile this afternoon.
"My lord dragon."
It was very hard not to scowl. Everything was going so well, and now this. Soralia knew he wanted Min today, more than for any previous audience. A chance for her to view Coiran and 2 more of Elida's emissaries was not to be missed. Soralia had promised to have her back. He moved away again, but Sulin followed, working at the buttons. "Sulin, I want you to go to Soralia's tent. Find Min and bring her here. No questions, Sulin. Just do it." She managed to smile and grind her teeth at the same time, a remarkable sight.
"As my lord dragon commands."
A smooth curtsy spread red and white skirts wide and lowered her face halfway to the floor. "How long?" he asked as she turned to go. There was no need to say until what. Her hesitation showed that she understood. At last she spoke, calmly and firmly, not grumbling at all.
"Until my shame equals theirs."
She looked him straight in the eye for a moment, the Sulin of old, if with longer hair, but just as quickly the mask returned.
"If my lord dragon will excuse me, I must run if I am to obey his command."
Which she did, lifting her skirts to her knees and darting out of the room. Rand shook his head and did up the last buttons himself. In truth, he felt good, except about Min, of course. Soralia had promised. Min had promised.
Once he fended off Koiran's inevitable questions as to whether he had decided to return to Tarvalin with her, he was going to sit Min down and... he was not sure what. But Alana was another day closer, a short time of listening to Koiran, and he would go work the sword for an hour.
"Demondred," Luz Theron snarled. "He wanted Ilyena."
As usual, the thought of Ilyena sent him off into distant weeping and moaning.
"Ilyena, O light, Ilyena."
Rand took the dragon scepter into the anteroom. Wondering who Koiran would bring, he sat in the tall chair on the dais to keep from pacing. Not over the Aes Sedai, over Min. She knew he needed her. She knew that. At last one of the doors opened, just enough to admit a woman, but it was Chiad, not Min. "The Aes Sedai are here, Ka'ar Karn." She said the title stiffly, still not sure about a wetlander as the chief of chiefs, and for that matter still not certain how to see him as the son of a maiden. Rand nodded, shifting himself upright and standing the dragon scepter erect on his knee.
"Send them in."
He was going to speak sharply to Min about this, giving all her time to the wise ones. Koiran glided in like a plump, self-important swan, followed by Galena and another raven-haired, hard-eyed woman with an Aes Sedai face. They were all in shades of gray today, chosen, he suspected, because it would not show the dust. To his surprise, once more, serving women with light dust cloaks hanging down their backs came behind the Aes Sedai, a full dozen laboring under the weight of two brass-bound chests, neither small. Some of the young women glanced at him, but most had their heads down, in concentration on their burdens, or maybe in fear. Rand's lip very nearly curled before he could stop it. They really did think they could buy him. "A pity your green sister is not here today," Galena said. His eyes whipped from the serving women to her. All three Aes Sedai were staring at him intently. How could they possibly know about Alana? There was no time for wondering, though. Almost at the same instant, his skin began to tingle. Fury leaped inside him, and in Luz Theron, too. Rand seized Sayadine nearly out of Luz Theron's teeth. White-hot rage roiled along the boundaries of the void, and contempt as he glared at Koiran and Galena and whoever the third was. Koiran's soft round jaw was set with determination. The other two actually smiled, eagerly and not at all pleasantly. They were as much fools as Marana and that lot. The shield, sliding between him and the true source, was like the closing of a sluice gate. The flow of Sidene vanished, leaving only the filthy residue of the taint. Beside that, the air seeming to turn solid around him from his ankles to his head was as nothing. That shield made his eyes bulge. It was impossible. No three women could block him from the source once he had taken hold of Sayadine. Not unless they were as strong as Semirag or Messana or... He reached for the source, battered at that invisible stone wall, harder, harder. Luz Theron was snarling like a beast, battering, clawing frantically. One of them had to be able to reach Sayadine. One of them had to be able to break a buffer held by only three. The block had only been in place moments when one of the serving women stepped up beside Galena, and Rand felt the blood drain from his face. Four sets of eyes in four ageless faces examined him.
"It is a great pity that it came to this."
In those calm, rolling tones, Koiran might better have been addressing a gathering than one man.
"I very much wanted you to come to Tarvalin on your own, but it became obvious you only intended to put us off. I suppose that you have had some contact from those poor fools who fled after the Sanche woman was stilled. Did you really believe they could offer you anything? As against the White Tower?"
She actually sounded disappointed in him. His eyes were the only part of him that could move. They slid toward the serving women, busy around one of the chests. It stood open, and they were lifting out a shallow tray. Some of those faces looked young, but the others... They were all Aes Sedai, he was sure. The five young women only knew enough that they had not yet assumed the agelessness. Five to look at him and lull his suspicions, while the others hid their faces. 15, Aes Sedai. 13 to link and weave a shield no man could break, and 2 to bind him. 13 to... Luce Theron fled, screaming.
Galena plucked the dragon scepter from Rand's hand, shaking her head over it.
I am in charge now, Coiran.
She never even looked at him. He might as well have been part of the chair.
It was agreed if it came to this, the Red Aja would take charge.
Handing the dragon scepter to the other black-haired woman in gray, she said,
Put this somewhere, Catherine. It might make an amusing souvenir for the Ammerlin.
Red Aja. Sweat oozed down Rand's face. If only the maidens outside would walk in now. Wise ones, Sulin. Anybody who could scream a warning, rouse the palace. 13 Aes Sedai and Red Aja in charge. Had he been able to open his mouth, he would have howled.
Bane looked up in surprise when the doors opened. Randall Thor had received the Aes Sedai a very little while ago, and automatically averted her eyes when she saw the serving women bringing out the chests. One of the black-haired Aes Sedai planted herself in front of her, and Bane hurriedly straightened from her crouch by the door. She hardly knew what to make of the tale the other maidens had told her in Camelin, the things only chiefs and wise ones had known once, but this woman's dark eyes seemed to know all about how the Aiel had failed so long ago. Those eyes held Bane's till she was only vaguely aware of the other night-haired Aes Sedai confronting Chiad, and the pompous one leading the women away down the corridor with the chests. Bane wondered whether the Aes Sedai facing her meant to kill her for the Aiel's failure. Surely they would have begun killing before now if they intended to. Surely they knew. But this woman's dark eyes glittered with a hardness that surely presaged death. Bane was not afraid to die. She only hoped she would have time to veil first. It seems young Master Althor is accustomed to coming and going from Cairhien when he chooses, the Aes Sedai told her in a voice like stone. We are not accustomed to anyone walking away from us rudely. If he returns to the palace in the next few days, we will return also. If not, our patience is not infinite. She glided away, she and the other, after the women with the chests. Bane exchanged quick looks with Chiad, and they hurried into Randall Thor's chambers.
What do you mean he's gone? Perrin demanded.
Loyal's ears twitched toward him, but the Ogier kept his eyes on the stones board as firmly as Fael did. She smelled... Perrin could make out nothing in the jumble of scents from her. That jumble made him want to bite his hands. Nandera only shrugged.
He does this sometimes.
She appeared calm enough, with her arms folded and her face impassive, but she smelled irritated, a scent like tiny burrs.
He slips away without even one maiden to guard his back, sometimes for as long as half a day. He thinks we do not know. I thought you might know where he has gone.
Something in her voice made Perrin think that if she found out, she intended to follow.
No, he sighed. I have no idea.
Pay attention to the game, Loyal,
Fael murmured. Surely you didn't mean to put a stone there. Perrin sighed again. Today he had decided to stay every moment at Fael's side. She would have to speak to him sooner or later, and besides, Berlane would surely leave him alone if he was with his wife. Well, at least Berlane had indeed left him alone, but as soon as Fael realized he was not going hunting again, she had collared Loyal before he could run off to the library, and they had been playing endless games of stones ever since. In silence, for all practical purposes, Perrin wished he were wherever Rand was. Lying on his back on the bed, Rand stared up at the thick basement rafters, not really seeing them. The bed was not large, but it had 2 feather mattresses and goose-down pillows and good linen sheets. There was a sturdy chair and a small table, plain yet well-made. His muscles still ached from being transported here inside one of the chests. The power had doubled him up easily, with his head between his knees. Simple cords had sufficed to make a package of him. Metal grating on metal made him turn his head. Galena had used a large iron key to unlock a flap in the iron cage that surrounded bed and table and chair. A graying woman with a wrinkled face thrust her arms inside the cage long enough to set a cloth-covered tray on the table, then all but leaped back.
"I intend to deliver you to the tower in reasonable health," Galena said coldly as she relocked the flap. "Eat, or you will be fed."
Rand turned his eyes back to the rafters. Six Aes Sedai sat in chairs around the cage, sustaining the shield on him. He maintained the void in case they should slip, but he did not lunge at the barrier. When they first pushed him stumbling into the cage, he had. Some of them had laughed, those who took any notice. Now he reached gingerly instead toward the fury of Saiyadin. A storm of fire and ice still just out of sight beyond the corner of his eye. He reached and felt at the invisible wall cutting him off from the source. Slid along it as though trying to find an edge. What he found was a place where the wall seemed to become 6 points. They stopped him as effectively, but they were 6, not 1, and definitely points. How long had he been here? A gray bleakness had settled over him, blanketing time, blanketing him in lethargy. He had been here long enough to be hungry, but the void made sensation distant, and even the smell of hot stew and warm bread coming from the covered tray sparked no interest. Rising seemed too much effort. So far, 12 Aes Sedai had taken turns around the cage, and not one a face he had seen before they appeared in the basement. How many were there in the house? That might be important later. Where was the house? He had no notion how far he had been carried in that chest, most of the way jolted about in a wagon or cart. Why had he forgotten Moraine's advice? Trust no Aes Sedai, not an inch, not a hair. 6 Aes Sedai channeling enough of Sidar to hold that shield should be felt outside by any woman who could channel. All he needed was a Mys or Bear or some other to pass by in the street and wonder. They had to be thinking now that he had vanished when Corrin left the palace. If there was a street outside, all he needed... He felt at the shield again, softly, so they would not feel. 6 points, 6 soft points, somehow. That had to mean something. He wished Luz Theron would speak again, but the only sound in his head was his own thoughts sliding along the void. 6 points.
Hurrying along the dusk-covered street by the great stone house where the Aes Sedai were, Cyrillia could barely sense them still channeling inside. She could only just sense it because she could only just channel at all, but that was not why she ignored it. They had been channeling day and night in there since their arrival. None of the wise ones wasted thought on why any longer. Cyrillia certainly had more important matters to think of now. Back at the Tree Killer's palace, the maidens were beginning to grow itchy over Randall Thor, muttering that the Karakarn would have some explaining to do when he returned this time. Cyrillia had lived a great deal longer than any of those maidens, longer than any other wise one, weak in the power or not, and she was uneasy. Like most men, Randall Thor went when he wished, where he wished. Men were like cats in that. But this time, at the same time he was flitting off, Min had vanished somewhere between the tents and the palace. Cyrillia did not like coincidences, no matter how many surrounded the Karakarn. Wrapping her shawl against a sudden feel of chill in her bones, she hurried on toward the tents.
Chapter 52. Weaves of the Power. The men sitting around the table in the common room of the Wandering Woman were mainly local. Those who wore the long vest sported it in bright silk, often brocaded, over pale shirts with wide sleeves. Garnets or pearls adorned finger rings. Hoop earrings were gold, not gilded, and moonstones and sapphires sparkled on the pommels of curved knives stuck through belts. Several men had silk coats slung about their shoulders, with a chain of silver or gold strung between the narrow lapels embroidered with flowers or animals. The coats looked odd, really. Too small to put on, never meant for anything but a cape. But their wearers carried long, narrow swords as well as the curved dagger, and seemed equally willing to use either, for a wrong word, a wrong look, or because they happened to feel like it. It was a varied crowd altogether. Two Morandian merchants with curled mustaches, and those ridiculous little beards on the point of the chin, and a Damani with hair below his shoulders and thin mustaches, who wore a gold bracelet, a close-fitting gold necklace, and a large pearl in his left ear. A dark Athan Mier, in a bright green coat, with tattooed hands and two knives thrust into a red sash, and a Tarabaner, with a transparent veil covering thick mustaches that almost hid his mouth, and a number of outlanders who might have been from anywhere. But every man had a pile of coins in front of him, though the size did vary. So close to the Tarasin Palace, the wandering woman attracted patrons with gold to spare. Rattling the five dice in the leather cup, Matt spun them out on the table. They stopped with two crowns, two stars, and a cup showing. A fair toss, no better. His luck ran in waves, and at the moment the waves seemed low, meaning he won no more than half his tosses at most. So far he had managed to lose 10 in a row, an unusual run for him at any time. The dice passed to a blue-eyed outlander, a hard, narrow-faced man who seemed to have plenty of coin to fling about despite his plain brown coat. Vannin bent to whisper in Matt's ear.
They're out again. Tom says he still doesn't know how.
Matt directed a grimace at the fat man that made him straighten more quickly than you would think someone his size could. Swallowing half the dew melon punch in his silver cup, Matt frowned down the table.
Again.
The blue-eyed man's toss rolled across the table and the dice stopped, showing three crowns, a rose, and a rod. Murmurs rounded the table at his win.
Blood and ashes, Matt muttered. Next, the daughter of the Nine Moons is going to walk in and claim me.
The blue-eyed fellow choked on his celebratory drink.
Do you know the name? Matt asked. My punch went down the wrong way, the man said in a soft, slurring accent Matt did not recognize. What name was that?
Matt made a pacifying gesture. He had seen fights start over less. Scraping his gold and silver back into his purse, he stuffed it into his coat pocket as he rose.
I am done. The light's blessing on all here.
Everyone at the table repeated the benison, even the outlanders. People were very polite in Ebu Dar. Even short of mid-morning, the common room was fairly full, and another dice game added its share of laughter and groans. Two of Mistress Anand's younger sons were helping the serving girls hand out late breakfasts. The innkeeper herself was sitting at the back of the room, near the railless white stone stairs, keeping an eye on everything, with a young, pretty woman whose big black eyes had a merry twinkle, as though she knew a joke no one else did. Her face was a perfect oval framed by glossy black hair, and the deep neckline of her red-belted gray dress showed a tantalizing view. The amusement in her eyes deepened as she smiled at Matt.
"With your luck, Lord Cawthon," Mistress Anand said, "my husband should ask you where to send his fishing boats."
For some reason, her tone was very dry. Matt accepted the title without a blink. In Ebu Dar, few would challenge a lord except other lords. It was a simple calculation of numbers to him. There were a lot fewer lords than commoners, which meant fewer chances somebody would try to stick a knife in him. Even so, he had had to crack three heads in the last 10 days.
I'm afraid my luck doesn't run to things like that, mistress.
Alvar seemed to just pop up at his side.
Can we go horse racing, Matt? He demanded eagerly.
Friella, Mistress Anand's middle daughter, trotted up to catch the boy by the shoulders.
Your pardon, Lord Cawthon, she said anxiously. He just slipped away from me. Light's truth, he did.
Soon to be married, the snug silver necklace for her marriage knife already encircled her slim throat, she had volunteered to look after Alvar, laughing about how she wanted 6 sons of her own. Matt suspected she was beginning to hope for daughters. It was Nalisian coming down the stairs who got Matt's glare, hard enough to stop the tyrant in his tracks. It was Nalician who had entered Wind in two races with Alvar riding. Boys did the riding here, and Matt not knowing a thing till it was done. That Wind had proven as fast as his name did not help matters. Two victories gave Alvar a taste for more.
"Not your fault, mistress," Matt told Friella.
"Put him in a barrel if you must, with my blessing." Alvar gave him an accusatory look, but a moment later he whipped around to give Friella an insolent grin he had picked up somewhere. It looked odd with his big ears and wide mouth. He was never going to be a handsome lad.
"I will sit quietly if I can look at your eyes. You have beautiful eyes."
Friella had a lot of her mother in her, and not just her looks. She laughed sweetly and chucked him under the chin, making him blush. Her mother and the big-eyed young woman smiled at the tabletop. Shaking his head, Matt started up the stairs. He had to speak to the boy. He could not just grin like that at every woman he saw. And telling a woman she had beautiful eyes, at his age? Matt did not know where Alvar got it. As he came abreast of Nalician, the man said, "They have sneaked away again, haven't they?" It was not a question, and when Matt nodded, he gave his pointed beard a yank and cursed. "I'll assemble the men, Matt." Narum was fussing about Matt's room, wiping the table with a cloth, as if the maids had not dusted this morning already. He shared a smaller room next door with Alvar, and rarely left the wandering woman. Ebudar was dissolute and uncivilized, he claimed.
"My lord is going out," Narum said lugubriously, as Matt picked up his hat. "In that coat? I fear there is a wine stain from last night on the shoulder. I would have removed it if my lord had not donned the garment in haste this morning, and a gash in the sleeve, from a knife, I believe, that I would have mended."
Matt let him bring out a gray coat with silver scrolls embroidered on the cuffs and high collar, and gave him the gold-embroidered green.
"I trust my lord will at least try not to get blood on it today. Bloodstains are very difficult to remove."
It was a compromise they had worked out. Matt put up with Narum's dismal face and gloomy observations and let the man fetch clean and hand him things he could just as easily pick up himself. In return, Narum agreed, reluctantly, not to try actually dressing him. Checking the knives snugged up his sleeves, under his coat, and in the turned-down tops of his boots, Matt left his spear leaning in the corner with his unstrung bow and went down to the front of the inn. That spear seemed to draw idiots who wanted to fight the way honey drew flies. In spite of his hat, sweat beaded on Matt's face the moment he stepped from the shade and relative coolness of the inn. The morning sun would have done for high noon in midsummer in ordinary times, but Mulhara Square was thronged with people. At first he stood frowning at the Tarasin Palace. With Julin and Tom watching inside and Vannin out, how were they managing to leave without being seen? They went out almost every single day. After it happened three times, Matt had set men watching every way out of that domed heap of white stone and plaster, taking their places before dawn. There were just enough of them with him and Nalician. No one had seen hide nor hair, but just before midday, Tom came out to say the women had gone somehow. The old gleeman seemed at his wit's end, ready to tear out his mustaches. Matt knew what was going on. They were doing it just to spite him. Nalician and the others were waiting in a glum, sweating knot. Nalician was fingering his sword hilt as though he would like an opportunity to use it today. "We'll look across the river today," Matt said. Several of the Red Arms exchanged uneasy glances. They had heard the stories. Vannin shifted his feet, shook his head.
"A waste of time," he said flatly. "Lady Elaine would never go anywhere like that. The Aiel woman, maybe, or Brigitta, but not Lady Elaine."
Matt closed his eyes for a moment. How had Elaine managed to ruin a good man in so short a time? He kept hoping that enough time away from her influence would set Vannin right, but he was beginning to lose hope. Light, but he despised noble women.
"Well, if we don't see them today, we can forget the Rahad. They'll stand out like painted larks in a flock of blackbirds over there."
but I intend to find them if they're hiding under a bed in the Pit of Doom. Search in pairs, as usual, and watch each other's back. Now to find some boatmen to ferry us across. Burn me, I hope they're not all out selling fruit to the sea folk ships.
To Elaine, the street looked as it had in Telairan Riod. Brick buildings 5 and 6 stories high, covered patchily with flaking white plaster, crowded together and looming above uneven pavement. Only at this time of day, with the golden sun burning overhead, did shadows vanish completely from these narrow ways. Flies buzzed everywhere. The only differences from the world of dreams were the laundry hanging from windows, the people, not many outdoors at the moment, of course, and the smell, a deep, pungent miasma of decay that made her try not to breathe too deeply. Unfortunately, every street looked alike in the Rahad. Halting Birgitta with a hand on her arm, she eyed a scabrous pile of brick with dingy washing dangling from half the windows. The thin wail of a baby crying came from somewhere inside. It had the right number of floors. 6. She was certain it had been 6. Nynaeve insisted on 5. "I don't think we should stand staring," Birgitta said softly. "People are looking." That was not quite true, just Birgitta worrying about her. Shirtless men in often ragged vests strutted down the street with sunlight glinting on their brass hoop earrings and brass finger rings set with colored glass, or slunk along like the sort of cur dog that might snarl and might bite. For that matter, so did the women, in their usually worn dresses and their jewelry of brass and glass. Everyone had a curved knife stuck through a belt, and frequently a plain work knife as well. In truth, no one gave her and Birgitta a second glance, though Birgitta's aged face was often challenging, and she herself was tall for an Ebudari woman. That was what they saw, by way of not-so-simple weaves of air and fire that Elaine had inverted and tied off herself. When Elaine looked at Birgitta, she saw a woman with fine wrinkles at the corners of black eyes and black hair touched with gray. The disguises were easier the closer you stayed to how a person really was, so the hair flowing down Birgitta's back, tied in 4 places with tattered green ribbon, was considerably longer than Ebudari women wore it. But then Elaine had not cut her hair either, and no one seemed to pay it any mind. It was a perfect disguise. She just wished she did not have to sweat as well. With the addition of the even more complex weave of spirit that masked a woman's ability to channel, Elaine had walked right by Merlilla on her way out of the palace that morning. She wore it still. They had seen Vandine and Adelius on this side of the river more than once. Their clothes were not part of the weaves, of course, but threadbare woolen dresses with frayed embroidery on the sleeves and around the deep, narrow necklines. Their shifts and stockings were wool, too, and Elaine's at least itched. Tylin had provided the garments, along with various pieces of advice, and the white-sheathed marriage knives. It seemed that married women were less likely to be challenged than unmarried, and widows who rejected another marriage least of all. Age helped, too. No one challenged a gray-haired grandmother, though she might you. "I think we should go in," Elaine said, and Birgitta moved ahead of her, one hand on the knife in her coarse brown woolen belt, to push open the unpainted door. Inside was a dim hallway lined with rough doors and a steep, narrow stairway of chipped brick at the back. Elaine did not quite sigh in relief. White sheaths or no white sheaths, walking into a building where you did not belong was one good way to end up in a knife fight here. So was asking questions or being curious. Tylin had counseled against that, but on the first day they had visited inns, marked only by blue doors, planning to say they were buying things out of old storerooms to refurbish and sell. She had paired with Birgitta and set Nynaeve with Avienda so they could cover more ground. The common rooms were dark, grimy places, and twice in as many stops Birgitta had hustled her out, both of them with daggers in hand, just before serious trouble started. The second time Elaine had to channel briefly, tripping a pair of women who came after them into the street. And even so, Birgitta had been certain that someone had followed them the rest of the day. Nynaeve and Davienda had the same sort of difficulty, except for being followed. Nynaeve had actually hit another woman with a stool. So even innocuous questions were abandoned, and they hoped they did not walk through a doorway into a knife. Birgitta climbed the steep stairs ahead, though she often glanced behind, too. The smells of cooking blended with the general stench of the Rahad in a quite sickening fashion. The baby stopped crying, but somewhere in the building a woman began shouting. On the third floor, a thick-shouldered man without shirt or vest opened a door just as they came up. Birgitta frowned at him, and he raised both hands, palms toward them, and backed out of the hallway again, kicking the door shut as he did. On the top floor, where the storeroom should have been if this was the right building, a gaunt woman in a coarse linen shift was sitting on a stool in the doorway, catching what little breeze was stirring while she sharpened her dagger. Her head swiveled toward them, and the blade stopped moving across the honing stone. She did not look away from them as they backed slowly down the stairway, and the soft rasp of metal on stone did not begin again until they reached the bottom of the flight. Elaine did let out a relieved breath then. She was more than glad Nynaeve had not taken her wager. 10 days. She had been an optimistic fool. This was the 11th day since her boast. 11 days when sometimes she thought she was on the same street in the evening as the morning. 11 days without a clue to the bowl. Sometimes they had remained in the palace just to clear their heads. It was all so frustrating. At least Van Deen and Adelius were having no luck either. As far as Elaine could see, no one in the Rahad would speak 2 willing words to Aes Sedai. People melted away as soon as they realized what they were. She had seen 2 women try to stab Adelius, no doubt to rob the fool walking the Rahad in a silk dress. And by the time the brown sister lifted the pair on flows of air and stuffed them through a window 2 floors up, there was not another person in sight. Well, she was not going to allow those 2 to find her bowl and snatch it from under her nose. Once back in the street, she had yet another reminder that there were worse things in the Rahad than frustration. Right in front of her, a slender man with blood all over his chest and a knife in his hand came leaping out of a doorway, spinning immediately to face another man who followed. The second was taller and heavier and bleeding down the side of his face. They circled each other, eyes locked, extended blades flickering and probing. A small crowd gathered to watch as though springing from the rough pavement. None came running, but no one passed by. Elaine and Birgitta moved to the side of the street, but they did not leave. In the Rahad, leaving would attract attention, the last thing they wanted. Blending in meant watching, but Elaine managed to focus beyond the 2 men, seeing only vague blurs of quick motion, until suddenly the motion slowed. She blinked and made herself look. The man with blood on her chest was parading about, grinning and gesturing with a blade that dripped red. The bigger man lay face down in the street, giving harsh, feeble coughs, not 20 paces from her. Elaine moved instinctively. Her minuscule ability in healing was better than none when a man was bleeding to death, and to the pit of doom with what anyone here thought of Aes Sedai. Yet before she took a second step, another woman was kneeling at the man's side. A little older than Nynaeve, perhaps, she wore a red-belted blue dress in somewhat better repair than most in the Rahad. Elaine took her for the dying man's sweetheart at first, especially when the victor in the duel grew sober. No one moved to go. Everyone watched silently as the woman turned the man onto his back. Elaine gave a start, as, far from tenderly wiping the blood from his lips, the woman pulled what seemed to be a handful of herbs from her pouch and hurriedly thrust some of them into the man's mouth. Before her hand left his face, the glow of Sidar surrounded her, and she began to weave the flows of healing more deftly than Elaine could have done. The man gasped hard enough to expel most of the leaves, shuddered, and lay still, half-open eyes staring at the sun. "Too late, it seems." Standing, the woman faced the lean fellow. "You must tell Masik's wife you've killed her husband, Barris." "Yes, Asra," Barris replied meekly. Asra turned away without another glance at either man, and the thin crowd opened up before her. As she passed within a few paces of Elaine and Birgitta, Elaine noticed two things about her. One was her strength. Elaine felt for that on purpose. She expected to feel a fair amount, but Asra likely would never have been allowed to take the test for accepted. Healing must have been her strongest talent, perhaps her only one, since she must be a wilder, and very well honed from use. Maybe she even believed those herbs were necessary. The second thing Elaine noticed was the woman's face. It was not sun-dark, as she had supposed at first. Asra was most certainly Domani. What under the light was a Domani wilder doing in the Rahad? Elaine might have followed the woman, except that Birgitta drew her the other way. "I recognize that look in your eyes, Elaine." Birgitta's eyes scanned the street, as if she expected some of the passers-by to be eavesdroppers. "I don't know why you want to chase after that woman, but she seems to be respected. Accost her, and you might have more blades drawn than you and I can handle together." That was simple truth, and so was the fact that Domani wilders were not what she had come to Ebu Dar to find. Touching Birgitta's arm, she nodded toward two men just rounding the corner ahead. In his satin-striped blue coat, Nalasian looked every inch the Tyran lord. The padded coat was done up to his neck, and his sweaty face glistened almost as much as his oiled beard. He glared at anyone who so much as glanced at him, to such an extent that he surely would have been in a fight by now, except that he was caressing his sword hilt as if he would welcome one. Matt, on the other hand, did not grimace at all. He swaggered along, and except for an air of disgruntlement, he could have been enjoying himself. With his coat hanging open and his hat pulled low and that scarf tied around his neck, he looked as if he had spent the night crawling through taverns, which he might very well have. To her surprise, she realized she had not thought of him in days. She itched to lay hands on his Turangrial, but the bowl was infinitely more important. "It never struck me before," Birgitta murmured, "but I think Matt is the more dangerous of those two. An Ashar in Mamaris. I wonder what they're doing this side of the Eldar." Elaine stared at her. "A what? Where?" "They have probably drunk all the wine on the other side. Really, Birgitta, I do wish you'd keep your mind on what we are about." This time she was not going to ask. As Matt and Nalasian sauntered on past, Elaine put them out of her mind again and began to study the street. It would be wonderful to find the bowl today, not least because the next time they came, she would be paired with Avienda. She was beginning to like the woman, despite her extremely peculiar notions about Rand and them. Extremely. But she did have a tendency to encourage women who seemed ready to draw a knife. Avienda even seemed disappointed that men dropped their eyes if she stared, instead of pulling out a blade the way the women would. "That one," Elaine said, pointing. "Nynaeve could not be right about five stories. Could she?" Elaine did hope Egwene had found a solution. Egwene waited patiently while Loghain drank some more water. His tent was not so spacious as his quarters had been in Salidar, but it was still larger than most in the camp. There had to be room for the six sisters sitting on stools, maintaining the shield on him. Egwene's suggestion that it be tied off had been met with close to shock and not far from scorn. No one was willing to countenance it, particularly now, so soon after she had raised four women Aes Sedai without testing or oath rod, and perhaps not ever. Swan had said they would not. Custom said six, though if he was as much reduced as Swan and Lyanna, any three sisters in the camp could surely have held him. And custom said the shield on a man must be maintained, not tied. A single lamp gave a fitful illumination. She and Loghain sat on blankets laid for rugs. "Let me understand," Loghain said when he lowered the pewter cup. "You want to know what I think of Althor's amnesty?" Some of the sisters shifted on their stools, maybe because he had omitted calling her mother, but more likely because they despised the subject. "I want your thoughts, yes. Surely you must have some. In Camelin with him, you would very likely be given a place of honor. Here you may be gentled any day. Now, you've held off the madness 6 years, you say. How much chance is there, do you think, that any men who come to him might do as well? Do they truly mean to gentle me again? His voice was quiet, his tone injured and angry. I've thrown my lot in with you. I've done all that was asked. I've offered to swear any oath you name. The hall will decide soon. Some would as soon you died conveniently. If Aes Sedai tell your tale, all know Aes Sedai cannot lie. But I don't believe you need fear that. You have served us too well for me to allow you to be harmed. And whatever happens, you can still serve and see the Red Aja punished as you wish. Loghain jerked up onto his knees, snarling, and she embraced Sidar and had him wrapped securely in flows of air in the space of a heartbeat. The sisters shielding him had all their strength directed into that. Another custom. You must use every bit of your strength to shield a man. But several could split their weaves, and one might have diverted part to him if they thought he might harm her. She did not want to risk him being injured. The flows held him there kneeling, but he seemed to ignore them. You want to know what I think of Althor's amnesty? I wish I were with him now. Burn you all! I have done everything you asked. The light burn you all! Be calm, Master Loghain. Egwene was surprised her voice came out steady. Her heart was racing, though certainly not for fear of him. I swear this to you. I will never harm you, nor allow you to be harmed by any who follow me if I can help it, unless you turn against us. The rage had gone from his face, replaced by woodenness. Was he listening? But the hall will do as it decides. Are you calm now? He nodded wearily, and she released the flows. He sank back to the ground, not looking at her. I will speak with you about the amnesty when you are more composed, perhaps in a day or two. He nodded again, curtly, still not looking. As she ducked out into the dusk, the two warders standing guard outside bowed to her. At least the Gaidin did not care that she was 18 and accepted raised Aes Sedai only because she was raised Amyrlin. To the warders, an Aes Sedai was an Aes Sedai, and the Amyrlin was the Amyrlin. Still, she did not let herself exhale until she was far enough away for the two not to hear. The camp was quite large, tents for hundreds of Aes Sedai spreading through the forest, for accepted and novices and servants, carts and wagons and horses everywhere. The cooking smell of the evening meal hung thick in the air. Around it stretched the cook fires of Gareth Bryn's army. Most men there would be sleeping on the ground, not in tents. The so-called Band of the Red Hand lay camped no more than 10 miles south. Talmanis never let that distance vary more than a mile or so either way, day or night for over 200 miles. Already they had served part of her plan for them, as suggested by Swan and Lyanna. Gareth Bryn's force had grown in the 16 days since leaving Salidar. 2 armies marching slowly northward through Altara, plainly not friendly toward each other, drew attention. Nobles flocked in with their levies to ally themselves with the stronger of the two. True, none of those lords and ladies would have sworn the oaths they had, if they had known there would be no great battle in their own lands. True, given free choice, every last one would have ridden the moment they realized Egwene's target was Tar Valon, not an army of dragons sworn. But they had made those oaths, to an Amyrlin at least, before Aes Sedai, who called themselves the Hall of the Tower, with hundreds more watching. Breaking that kind of vow came back to haunt you. Besides, even if Egwene's head ended on a pike in the White Tower, not a one of them believed Elida would forget they had sworn. Trapped into alliance they might have been, and into fealty of a sort, but they would be among the most fervent of her supporters. Their only way out of that trap with their necks intact was to see Egwene wearing the stole in Tar Valon. Swan and Lyanna were quite set up over it. Egwene was not certain how she felt. If there had been some way to remove Elida without a drop of blood being shed, she would have leaped at it. She did not think there was, though. After a small dinner of goat, turnip, and something she did not inquire after too closely, Egwene retired to her tent. Not the largest in the camp, but certainly the largest occupied by one person. Chesa was there, waiting to help Egwene undress, bubbling over the news that she had acquired some of the finest linen imaginable from an Altaran lady's maid, filmy material that would make the coolest shifts imaginable. Often Egwene let Chesa sleep in the tent with her for the company, though a pallet of blankets hardly equaled Chesa's own cot. Tonight she sent the woman away once she was ready for bed. Being Amarlin entailed a few privileges, such as a tent of her own for your maid, such as sleeping alone on nights when it was necessary. Egwene was not tired enough to go to sleep yet, but that was no trouble. Putting herself to sleep was a simple matter. She had been trained by Aiel dreamwalkers. She stepped into Telairun Riod and was standing in the room that had been her study in the little tower for such a brief time. The table and chairs remained, of course. Furniture was not something you took away when you set out with an army. Any place felt empty in the world of dreams, but those that really were, more than most. Already the little tower felt hollow. Abruptly she realized the Amarlin's stole was draped around her neck. She made it vanish just in time. An instant later Nynaeve and Elaine were there, Nynaeve as solid as she, Elaine misty. Swan had been reluctant to let go of the original ring Tarangrial. A firm order had been necessary. Elaine wore a green dress with lace spilling over her hands and outlining a narrow yet startlingly deep neckline that revealed a small knife dangling from a snug gold necklace, the hilt nestled between her breasts a mass of pearls and fire drops. Elaine always did seem to embrace the local fashions immediately, wherever she went. Nynaeve, as expected, wore stout Two Rivers woolens, dark and plain. "Success?" Egwene said hopefully. "Not yet, but we will." Elaine sounded so optimistic that Egwene almost stared. She had to really try to sound that way. "I'm sure it will not be much longer," Nynaeve said, sounding even more positive. "They must be beating their heads against a wall." Egwene sighed. "Maybe you should join me again. I'm sure you could find the bowl in a few more days, but I keep thinking about all these stories." They could take care of themselves. She knew that, and it would be a fine thought to have over their graves. Swan said that none of the stories they had told were exaggerations. "Oh no, Egwene," Nynaeve protested. "The bowl is too important. You know it is. Everything is going to cook in its own juice if we don't find it. Besides," Elaine added, "what kind of trouble can we fall into? We sleep every night in the Tarasin Palace, in case you've forgotten, and if Tylin doesn't tuck us in, she is still there to talk." Her dress was different, the cut unaltered, but the material was coarse and worn. Nynaeve wore a near copy of it, except that her knife had no more than 9 or 10 glass beads on the hilt. Hardly clothes for any palace. Worse, she was trying to look innocent. Nynaeve had no practice at that. Egwene let it pass. The bowl was important. They could take care of themselves, and she knew very well they were not looking in the Tarasin Palace. She almost let it pass anyway. "You are making use of Matt, aren't you?" "We..." Abruptly, Elaine became aware of her dress and gave a start. For some reason, though, it seemed to be the small knife that truly startled her. Eyes popping, she clutched the hilt, a mass of large red and white glass beads, and her face went absolutely crimson. An instant later, she was in a high-necked Andoran gown of green silk. The funny thing was, Nynaeve realized what she was wearing only a heartbeat behind Elaine and reacted exactly the same. Exactly. Except maybe that if Elaine blushed like a sunset, Nynaeve blushed for two. She was back into Two Rivers woolens even before Elaine changed. Clearing her throat, Elaine said breathily, "Matt is quite useful, I'm sure, but we cannot allow him to get in our way, Egwene. You know how he is. You can be sure, though, if we do anything dangerous, we will have him and all his soldiers cheek to cheek around us." Nynaeve was silent and looking sour, perhaps remembering Matt's threat. "Nynaeve, you won't push it, Matt, too hard, will you?" Elaine laughed. "Egwene, she is not pushing at him at all." "That's the simple truth," Nynaeve put in quickly. "I've not said a cross word to him since we arrived in Ebudar." Egwene nodded doubtfully. She could reach the bottom of this, but it would take... She glanced down to make sure the stole had not reappeared, and saw only a flicker that even she could not recognize. "Egwene," Elaine said, "have you been able to speak with the Dreamwalkers yet?" "Yes," Nynaeve said. "Do they know what the problem is?" "I have," Egwene sighed. "They don't. Not really." It had been an odd meeting only a few days ago, begun by finding Bear's dreams. Bear and Milane had met her in the Stone of Tyr. Amys had said she would not teach Egwene more, and she did not come. At first, Egwene felt awkward. She could not bring herself to tell them she was Aes Sedai, much less Amyrlin, afraid they might believe it another lie. There had certainly been no difficulty with the stole appearing then. And then there was her toe to Milane. She brought it up, thinking all the while about how many miles she had to spend in a saddle the next day, but Milane was so full of pleasure that she was going to have daughters, she rhapsodized over Min's viewing, that she not only announced straight away that Egwene had no toe toward her, but said she was going to name one of the girls Egwene. That had been a small pleasure in a night full of futility and irritation. "What they said," she went on, "was that they had never heard of anyone trying to find something with need again after they had already found it. Bear thought maybe it was like trying to eat the same apple twice. The same motai was what Bear had said. A motai was a kind of grub found in the waste, quite sweet and crunchy, until Egwene found out what she was eating." "You mean... we just can't go back to the storeroom?" Elaine sighed. "I was hoping we were doing something wrong. Oh, well, we'll find it anyway." She hesitated, and her dress changed again, though she did not seem to notice. It was still Andoran, but red, with the white lions of Andor climbing the sleeves and marching across the bodice. A queen's dress, even without the rose crown resting on her red-gold curls. But a queen's dress with a close-fitting bodice that showed perhaps more cleavage than an Andoran queen would.
"Egwene, did they say anything about Rand?"
"He's in Cairhien, lolling about in the Sun Palace, it seems." Egwene managed not to wince. Neither Bear nor Milane had been very forthcoming, but Milane muttered darkly about Aes Sedai, while Bear said that they should all be beaten at regular intervals. Whatever Cyrillia said, a simple beating should be enough. Egwene was very much afraid that somehow Myrana had managed to put a foot very wrong. At least he was putting Elida's emissaries off. She did not think he knew how to handle them nearly as well as he thought he did.
"Perrin is with him. And Perrin's wife. He married Fael."
That brought exclamations. Nynaeve said Fael was much too good for him, but said it smiling broadly. Elaine said she hoped they would be happy, but she sounded doubtful for some reason. "Loyal is there, too, and Min. All it needs is Matt and the three of us." Elaine bit her underlip.
"Egwene, would you pass a message to the Wise Ones for Min? Tell her..."
She hesitated, chewing her lip in thought.
"Tell her I hope she can come to like Avienda as much as she likes me."
"I know that sounds odd," she laughed. "It's a private matter between us." Nynaeve looked at Elaine as oddly as Egwene knew she herself was.
"I will, of course.
I don't mean to talk with them again for some time, though." There was not much point when they were as uncommunicative concerning Rand as they were, and as hostile toward Aes Sedai.
"Oh, that is fine," Elaine said quickly. "It really isn't important." "Well, if we can't use need, then we must use feet, and in Ebudar mine are aching right now. If you don't mind, I will go back to my body and get some real sleep. You go ahead, Nynaeve said. I will be just a little while. When Elaine vanished, she turned to Egwene. Her dress had changed, too, and Elaine thought she knew very well why. It was a soft blue, cut low. There were flowers in her hair and ribbons through her braid, as there would be for her wedding back home. Egwene's heart went out to her. "Have you heard anything of Lan?" Nynaeve asked quietly. "No, Nynaeve, I haven't. I am so sorry. I wish I could tell you better. I know he's still alive, Nynaeve, and I know he loves you as much as you love him." "Of course he's alive," Nynaeve said firmly. "I won't allow anything else. I mean to make him mine. He is mine, and I won't let him be dead." When Egwene woke herself, Swan was sitting beside her cot, dimly seen in the darkness. "Is it done?" Egwene asked. The glow surrounded Swan as she wove a small ward against eavesdropping around the pair of them. Of the 6 sisters on duty beginning at midnight, only 3 have warders, and those Gaideen will be on guard outside. They will have mint tea brought to them, with a small addition they shouldn't taste. Egwene closed her eyes for a moment. "Am I doing the right thing?" "You ask me?" Swan choked out. "I did as I was commanded, Mother. I'd as soon jump into a school of feeding silver pike as help that man escape if it were up to me." "They will gentle him, Swan." Egwene had been over this with her, but she needed to go over it again for herself, to convince herself she was not making a mistake. "Even Shiriam doesn't listen to Carlinia anymore, and Lelaine and Romanda are pressing for it. That or someone really will do what Delana has been hinting at. I won't allow murder. If we cannot try a man and execute him, we have no right to arrange for him to die. I will not let him be murdered, and I cannot allow him to be gentled. If Marana really has put Rand's back up somehow, that will be tossing fatwood in the fire. I just wish I could be sure he will go to Rand and join him instead of running off the light knows where, doing the light knows what. At least that way there might be some way to control what he does." She heard Swan shift in the darkness. "I always thought the stole weighed about as much as 3 good men," Swan said quietly. "The Ammerlin has few easy decisions to make, and fewer where she can be sure. Do what you must, and pay the price if you're wrong. Sometimes if you are right, too." Egwene laughed softly. "It does seem to me I have heard that before." After a while, her mirth died. "Make sure he doesn't hurt anyone leaving, Swan." "As you command, Mother." "This is terrible," Nissau muttered. "If it becomes known, the condemnation will be enough to drive you into exile, Mirella, and me with you. 400 years ago it might have been commonplace, but no one will think it so today. Some will call it crime." Mirella was glad the moon was down already. It hid her grimace. She could handle the healing herself, but Nissau had been studying how to deal with sicknesses of the mind, things the power could not touch. Mirella was not sure this counted as a sickness, but she would try whatever tool might work. Nissau could say what she would. Mirella knew she would cut off her own hand rather than pass up this chance to further her studies. She could feel him out there in the night, coming closer. They were well away from the tents, well beyond the soldiers, with only scattered trees round them. She had felt him from the moment his bond passed to her, the crime Nissau fretted over. A warder's bond passed from one Aes Sedai to another without his consent. Nissau was right in one point. They would have to keep this secret as long as they could. Mirella could feel his wounds, some almost healed, some almost fresh, some badly infected. He would not have gone aside to seek battle. He had to come to her, as surely as a boulder tipped down a mountain had to roll on to the bottom. He would not have moved one foot to stand aside from battle either. She had felt his journey in distance and blood, his blood, across Cairion and Andor, Murundi and now Altara,
through lands infested with rebels and rogues, bandits and dragonsworn, focused on her like an arrow speeding to the target, carving his way through any armed man who stood in his path. Even he could not do that unharmed. She totted up his injuries in her mind and wondered that he was still alive. The sound of a horse's hooves came to her first, a steady walk, and only then did she make out the tall black war horse in the night. Night seemed to be the rider, too. He would be wearing his cloak. The horse stopped a good 50 paces from her.
"You shouldn't have sent Newell and Croy out to find me," the unseen rider called in a rough voice. "I almost killed them before I saw who they were. Eivor, you might as well come out from behind that tree."
Off to the right, the knight seemed to move. Eivor wore his cloak, too, and he would not have expected to be seen.
"This is madness," Nisau muttered. "Be quiet," Mirella hissed.
In a louder voice, she called, "Come to me." The horse did not move. A wolfhound mourning his dead mistress did not come to a new mistress willingly. Delicately she wove spirit and touched the part of him that contained her bond. It had to be delicate, or he would be aware of it, and only the Creator knew what sort of explosion might result.
"Come to me."
This time the horse came forward, and the man swung down to stride the last paces, a tall man, moon shadows making his angular face seem carved of stone. Then he was standing in front of her, standing over her, and as she stared up into Lan Mandragoran's cold blue eyes, she saw death. The light help her. How was she ever to keep him alive long enough?
Chapter 53, The Feast of Lights. The people dancing in the streets of Cairhien exasperated Perrin. Making a way through was near to impossible. A line dance snaked past him behind a big-nosed fellow with a flute and no shirt. Last in line pranced a round little woman who laughed merrily and took a hand from the waist of the man in front of her to try pulling Perrin in behind. He shook his head, and either his yellow eyes frightened her, or his face looked as grim as he felt, because she swallowed her mirth and let the line lead her on, glancing back over her shoulder at him until the crowd hid her. A graying woman, still handsome, with slashes of color halfway to the waist of her dark silk dress, flung slender arms around Perrin's neck and stretched up her mouth hungrily toward his. She looked startled when he picked her up gently under the arms and set her down out of his way. A group of men and women his own age, capering to timbres, bumped into him, laughing gaily and plucking at his coat. They ignored his head-shaking until finally he pushed one of the men away hard and snarled a lead-wolf growl at the others. Laughter vanished in gaping astonishment for a moment, but they were roaring again and trying to imitate his growl before they frolicked away into the throng. It was the first day of the Feast of Lights, the shortest day of the year, the last day of the year, and the city celebrated in ways Perrin could never have imagined. There would be dancing in the two rivers, but this... The Cairhienin seemed determined to make up for a year of staid reserve in the 2 days of the feast. Propriety had gone down the well, and with it every barrier between common and noble, in public at least. Perspiring women in plain rough wool seized sweaty men in color-striped dark silks and pulled them into the dance. Men in carter's coats and stablemen's vests whirled women whose dresses bore slashes of color sometimes to the waist. Bare-chested men poured wine over themselves and anyone else close to them. Apparently any man could kiss any woman kiss any man, and they were doing so with great abandon everywhere Perrin looked. He tried not to look too closely. Some of the noble women, with their hair in elaborate towers of curls, were bare to the waist beneath light cloaks that they made little effort to keep closed. Among the commoners, a few women who had abandoned their blouses bothered with any sort of covering beyond their hair, and that seldom near long enough. They flung wine over themselves and everyone else as wildly as any man. Boisterous laughter, warred with a thousand different tunes from flutes and drums and horns, zithers and bitterns and dulcimers. The women's circle in Emmons Field would have had a screaming fit, and the village council swallowed their tongues in apoplexy. But the depraved goings-on were only a small burr added to Perrin's irritation. A few hours, Nandera had said, but Rand had been gone 6 days now. Min had either gone with him or was staying with the Aiel, and no one seemed to know anything. Except for the one called Sorlea, the wise ones were evasive as any Aes Sedai when Perrin managed to corner one. Sorlea told him bluntly to tend to his wife and keep his nose out of affairs that did not concern wetlanders. How Sorlea knew of the trouble between Fael and him, he had no idea, but he did not care. He could feel Rand's need like an itch everywhere under his skin, stronger every day. He was coming from Rand's school now, a last resort, but everyone there was as caught in drink, dance, and debauchery as the rest of Kyrian. A woman named Idrian had been named to him as the head of the school, but after he managed, with some difficulty and no small embarrassment, to interrupt her kissing a man young enough to be her son, long enough to ask his question, all she could say was that maybe a man named Fel might know something. And Fel turned out to be dancing with three young women who could have been his granddaughters. With all three at once. Fel hardly seemed able to remember his own name, perhaps not surprising in the circumstances. Burnrand. He had gone off without a word when he knew about Min's viewing, knew he was going to need Perrin desperately. Even the Aes Sedai had grown disgusted, apparently. Just that morning, Perrin had learned that they were 3 days on their way back to Tar Valon, having said there was no further point in remaining. What was Rand up to? That itch had Perrin wanting to bite something. When he reached the Sun Palace, every lamp was lit and candles burned everywhere one could be placed. The corridors glittered like gems in the sun. In the Two Rivers, too, every house would be illuminated, with every available lamp and candle, until sunrise the day after tomorrow. Most of the palace servants were out in the streets, and the few who remained seemed to laugh and dance and sing, as much as work. Even here some women were bare to the waist, girls barely old enough to have their hair braided in the Two Rivers, and gray-haired grandmothers. The Aiel in the corridors looked disgusted when they noticed, which in truth they did not seem to do very often. The maidens in particular appeared furious, though Perrin suspected that had nothing to do with Kyrianan women exposing themselves. The maidens had been more and more cats lashing their tails every day since Rand went. Perrin strode through the hallways openly for a change. He almost wanted Berylaine to pounce on him. The image that flashed in his mind was of him seizing the scruff of her neck in his teeth and shaking her until she was ready to run away with her tail curled under. Perhaps fortunately, he reached his rooms without seeing a hair of her. Fael almost looked up from the stones board when he entered. Perrin was sure she did. The scent of jealousy still wafted from her, but it was not the strongest. Anger was sharper, if not at its worst, and most powerful was a flat, dull odor he identified as disappointment. Why was she disappointed in him? Why would she not speak to him? One word, even hinting at everything returning to how it had been, and he would be on his knees to accept blame for anything she wanted to pile on his head. But she only placed a black stone and murmured, "It is your turn, Loyal." "Loyal?" Loyal's ears were twitching uneasily, and his long eyebrows drooped. The Ogier might have no sense of smell to speak of, well, no better than Fael, say, but he could sense mood where no human would see anything. When Perrin and Fael were in the same room, Loyal looked as though he wanted to cry. Now he just sighed like wind blowing through a cavern and put a white stone where he would begin trapping a large part of Fael's stones if she did not notice. She probably would. She and Loyal were evenly matched, far better players than Perrin. Sulin came to the bedchamber door with a pillow in her arms, frowning at Fael and at Perrin. Her scent reminded Perrin of a she-wolf who had taken about all of Cub's nipping her tail in play that she could stand. She also smelled worried. And afraid, oddly. Though why a white-haired serving woman smelling afraid should be odd, even one with Sulin's scarred, leathery face, Perrin did not understand. Scooping up a book with a leather cover worked in gilt, Perrin sank into a chair and flung the volume open. yet he did not read or even see the book well enough to know which one he had picked up. He inhaled deeply, filtering out everything but Fail. Disappointment, anger, jealousy, and underneath that, underneath even the faint, fresh herbal smell of her soap, was her. Perrin breathed her in hungrily. One word, that was all she had to say. When a knock sounded at the door, Sulan stalked out of the bedroom, flouncing her red and white skirts and glaring at Perrin and Fail and Loyal, as if wondering why one of them had not answered it. She sneered quite openly when she saw Dobrain. She seemed to do that quite often since Rand left, but then took a deep breath as if steeling herself and visibly forced an almost cringing mildness. Her deep curtsy might have done to greet a king who enjoyed being his own headsman, and there she remained, her face nearly on the floor. Suddenly she began trembling. The smell of her anger melted, and even the worry was overwhelmed by a scent like thousands of hair-fine, needle-sharp splinters. Perrin had smelled shame from her before, but this time he would have said she might die from it. He smelled the bitter sweetness women gave off when they wept from emotion. Of course, Dobrain never even glanced at her. Instead, his deep-set eyes studied Perrin, his face sober, even somber, below his shaved and powdered forehead. Dobrain did not smell of drink even faintly, and he hardly looked as if he had been dancing. The one time Perrin had met him before, he had thought the man smelled wary. Not afraid, but as though he was padding through tangled woods full of poisonous snakes. That smell was 10 times stronger today.
"Grace favor you, Lord Ebarra," Dobrain said, inclining his head. "May I speak with you alone?"
Perrin set the book on the floor beside his chair and